you connect with us, it is imperative that you support that which supports you. If you're an appointment listener to Democracy Now!, we say this all the time, but it is incumbent upon you to support that which supports you. You tune in a little before 8 to ensure that you're here for the top of Democracy Now!. So we ask you now to go to the phones and support it during our winter pledge drive. We have only one more day to appeal to you. As we move to On the Margin, we thank you for your continued support. Keep the calls coming. And up next is E. Ethelbert Miller with On the Margin. You're in tune to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Ala Vassell. Ala Vassell is the co-editor of Mapping Black Europe, Monuments, Markers, and Memories. She edited this book with Natasha Kelly. Ala Vassell is currently directs the digital media program at the University of District of Columbia. How are you doing this morning, Ala?
Good morning, Ethelbert. I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. And you are joining us during our winter fundraising drive. And so we'll be encouraging our listeners to call in 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 and make a pledge and help us reach our goal. I want to take you back to May 25th, 2020. And that was the day that George Floyd was killed. Talk about where you were and how you responded to this tragedy.
Thank you. May 2020, very obviously, like everybody else, I was at home locked in during the COVID epidemic. And I don't even think I was actually watching television or in any kind of media. And I started getting phone calls from friends and family, not only here in the United States, but also from overseas. I am from the UK, and they were sort of ahead in terms of time. And I just got these calls from people who were asking, you know, what is happening over there? What is this? This is awful. This is terrible. This is tragic. We can't understand what's going on. And I quite frankly, I was in shock. I turned on the television and started seeing the reports of what had happened. And quite honestly, even though I've been in this country for many, many years, I was still in shock and in distress and in dismay to see that in the 21st century, this kind of thing was still happening. So it was a great shock. And quite honestly, I was at a loss to explain it to people outside of the country, particularly my friends and family in Europe.
Mm. You know, when you think about it, I'm always looking at how one incident becomes much more goes viral more than another. But, you know, before that, we had Trayvon Martin. That scene, that was another very big case. How did you respond to that one also?
Yeah, in actual fact, and I'm going to go from the perspective a little bit more about being about the European context, the Black European context.
Right, because I want to move into your book.
Yeah, and I can really speak to that because, you know, we did, all over Europe, protest the murder of Trayvon Martin, and so on and so on and so forth. We've been actively engaged and, you know, in protesting these awful murders that have been taking place in the US, even as we saw similar actions happening in our own countries. So we've really very much felt a kinship what was happening in the US, and Black Lives Matter obviously ported to, well, maybe not so obviously ported to all over Europe, including to the UK. And we stood side by side with African Americans in this struggle and in this fight and in this absolute horror as to what was going on here.
Let's talk about, you know, in Mapping Black Europe, you document the impact of Floyd's death on several European cities, as well as at the Black Lives Matter movement that you were just talking about. Talk about, has the protests in terms of police brutality, has there been of solutions being proposed, you know, in terms of, you know, we had a thing about body cameras, defund the police. And then also I was wondering, I mean, your book focuses on the big city. I was wondering about police brutality incidents outside of the major cities like of Paris or London.
So Europe, as you know, is a lot monolithic. They're very different responses in different European countries. In the UK, what was interesting is in 2020 we had a Conservative government, and one of the things that happened was that the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson created a commission that reported on or investigated racism and police brutality and these things in British society. And perhaps to no surprise, that commission report came back saying that, you know, there was no institutional racism and et cetera, in the UK. And to the great disappointment, obviously, though not to surprise, of Black communities in the UK. And yes, police brutality is systemic throughout the country, I think, because London has the highest concentration of people of color, Black people. You see more reports there. Same thing with Paris. As we'll find out, one of the reasons that we chose capital cities was because those are usually the places where Black communities generally reside in the greatest numbers. So there was a sort of effort to really capture the stories of Black communities where they are most numerous.
Talk about how much of this is also, you know, anti-immigration, you know, responses, because I'm thinking about how during World War II, a lot of people from, like, say, the West Indies came to England, taking the jobs and things that were necessary, and then decided to stay there. I always think of Barbados being Little England, you know. But I was also wondering, in terms of now, what we see in the last, you know, getting past the 50s and 60s, we've seen this anti-immigration focus as being one that drives a lot of the police brutality.
Yeah, there is definitely a connection there. And if I can speak to what was a very big case and probably can really best illustrate some of the issues around immigration and belonging and citizenship, was the Windrush scandal. Mm-hmm. In 2018 in the UK, the Conservative government had a policy of essentially, it was a hostile environment policy where they were trying to make it difficult for people of color, immigrants of color from the Caribbean, especially, to reside in the UK. And if I could just give you context about the Windrush generation, which my parents were a part, is that the Caribbean countries, many countries in the Caribbean were obviously British colonies. And at a certain point, as you said, post-World War II, Britain asked that, you know, people from their colonies come to the UK to essentially take over the jobs that, you know, were now needed because of all the deaths in World War II. And they came often with their children, and those children, you know, had no passports, etc., and, you know, and were just British residents, as it were. And so in 2018, the government started to kind of look at, you know, who was officially a resident and not, et cetera. And many of the Windrush generation, their children, they were told essentially that they weren't residents and that they had to leave. Some traveled, for example, to the Caribbean for the first time or somewhere else and were not permitted to return. Etc. Some were in jobs and were fired, lost their benefits, this kind of thing turned into a really, really huge scandal, which kind of directly links to the work that we did around marking our presence in Europe.
What did you and your co-editor, Natasha Kelly, want to explore in your book, Mapping Black Europe?
Well, we really wanted to make visible, you know, the lives of people of African descent in Europe, because I think, not so much now, but certainly, 20 years ago or so, even 10 years ago, people weren't aware of the fact that, you know, there are, you know, significant Black communities in Europe. I remember when I first came here, admittedly 30 years ago, people often thought that, you know, my father had been in the military or something, and that was how I had come to be in British and, you know, etc. But in actual fact, we've been there, and I can speak again to the UK very well. We've been there since Roman times, and in fact, in the 1500s, there were so many Black people in London that Elizabeth I actually kind of decried their presence and wanted to get rid of them. So, you know, and then we've had continuous histories, but these histories, we were invisible in terms of those histories. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons was because, you know, obviously our stories weren't told, but there were no markings of our presence or our contribution to the societies where we'd been. And, you know, the same thing in France, you know, the same thing in Rome, the same thing in...
Well, you know, I want to look at, you know, you're dealing with, you know, monuments and markers, but I want to ask you about curriculum, you know, in terms of what is happening. Was there a push to incorporate the history of Black people into the classroom?
Again, because we're talking about so many different countries.
Well, let's just deal with England right now.
Let's deal with England. Yes. So Mary Seacole, who is somebody that, you know, many of us in Britain have heard of in terms of Black Britain, was a nurse during the Crimean War in the 1800s. And she was a contemporary of Florence Nightingale, which most people have heard of. Florence Nightingale, I'm not sure outside of the UK. But well known as somebody that, you know, really helped tend to soldiers during that war, British soldiers during that war. And Mary Seacole was a woman of Jamaican, mixed heritage Jamaican, and I think of British or Scottish heritage. And she came to the UK and decided on her own that she was going to go and offer her services as a nurse. She'd been trained in natural healing by her mother in Jamaica. She would offer her services to soldiers in the Crimean War, and she was rebuffed by the British establishment and went on her own and effectively did a great job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, she was a very important person for us. In the early 2000s, there was a poll about a BBC poll about the greatest Black Britons, and there wasn't one Black Briton mentioned there. So we did our own poll, and Mary Seacole came out on top. So there was, after that, she was placed on the curriculum as somebody that in high schools and perhaps lower down as somebody that should be known as being a great Briton, not just a great Black Briton as voted by Black British people, but Great Briton, who'd significantly contributed to the country's well-being, etc. There was, at one point with the Conservative government, she was taken off the curriculum after a concerted sort of campaign to say, you know, this woman, you know, she wasn't even really Black, or she wasn't really a nurse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she was eventually put back on. But that's a continual fight.
Okay. Well, yeah, while there's a continual fight, there's also here at WPFW a continual fight to raise money. And so now I think I'll bring Katia Stitt in to encourage people.
What a transition. Good morning, Ms. Vassell. It's so nice to have you on. And thank you, Ethelbert. Good morning, everyone. Again, we are in our Winter Pledge Drive. This is your last opportunity to support On the Margin. And we're asking for a modest goal this morning of $500, and we can do this. I know, like every conversation Ethelbert ever has, like every guest Ethelbert ever books, you are riveted, you are glued to the radio, you don't want to take a moment to move. But what would be lovely is if we help him make his goal today, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. This is Black History Month in the U.S. We know it's a different month in the UK, but you know, wherever there are Black people, it is Black history. And of course, we see the erasure of that through our governmental policies, but it'll never be erased here at WPFW, and Ethelbert is often bringing it to the fore. So we ask you now to pledge your support, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org to connect. $500 to go. Ethelbert, let's go.
Okay, Olive, we were talking about England, but in your book, Mapping Black Europe, you also write the chapter on France and Paris. Talk about the connection between England and Paris in terms of this police brutality. There were certain cases in Paris that became very popular. And then I also would look at the fact that last year we were celebrating the 100th anniversary of James Baldwin's birth. And we know that during the 1950s, when he's in France, there is that concern about how people from Algeria are being treated.
Yes. Okay. So a lot to unpack there. One thing that I'd kind of like to say that is kind of interesting on a personal note is that I began my journey into wanting to even know about Black Europe from when I first went to Paris as a 13-year-old. And I was in the streets wandering around and I saw people who looked like me, but I literally couldn't speak to them. I had no idea why I couldn't speak to them or who they were or how they'd come to be where they were. So it began that journey for me, and I studied French and became a linguist so that I could in part be able to communicate with people who look like me. So yes, France has a very interesting way in terms of the way it colonized, which is kind of different from the British version, in that it tried to incorporate, at least on the surface, Black people into the French ideal, if you will like. And let me tell you what that looks like in practicality. It means that in France, they don't count race. So you can't know how many Black people are in the country officially or have jobs or don't have jobs. So, and this is, although on the surface it may seem like, oh, wow, colorblind, it ends up being a problem that you don't know what issues this particular community is facing. Mm-hmm. So like the UK, France called people from its colonies to France after the Second World War, but mainly in the kind of 50s, 60s, a little bit later than they did in the and 70s really, than in the UK. And they came from all over, from the African continent, from the Caribbean. And incidentally, France still has départements like Martinique and Guadeloupe, mm-hmm. et cetera. So when you're in the center of Paris, you can see a sign going, how many thousands of kilometers to Martinique, which is kind of, I won't spend too much time on that. But just like, the rest of Europe, police brutality has been a real issue. I can talk about kind of one particular case.
Yeah, talk about one particular case that you mentioned in your book, Mapping Black Europe.
A young man whose name was, 24-year-old man, whose name was Adama Touré. He died in police custody in 2016. And his sister founded a movement called the Committee for Justice and Truth for Adama, really declaring that her brother had died as a result of the racist system and sort of vowing to keep his name alive. So you see, we have our own incidences that, has allowed us really to have a natural synergy with what is going on here in the US and looking to the US in many cases to, you know, allow the Black Lives Movement to help us really tackle these issues and to join together.
But let's look at that point. Why do we hear, you know, you're hearing about George Floyd and say, oh, see, how come we're not hearing some of the cases that are taking place in these various European cities that would come back the same way, you know, you responded to George Floyd? I can't think of a case, a major case coming out of Paris that people were, you know, in DC protesting.
Yeah, and that is the same, believe it or not, it's until I did this book, I didn't know about many of these cases myself. And this goes back to, we don't speak the same languages, so we don't know each other's stories in Europe, and didn't for a long time until the internet allowed us to break through the barriers of what was going on. And quite honestly, America, as you know, is larger than life. And so we know American news, American entertainment, American life is everywhere, but it doesn't translate back the same way.
Well, what about the influence? It's like, I'm looking at young people now. Because when we look at hip hop, it's international. I'm just wondering how songs, you know, or things associated with graffiti, symbols, you know, become part of everybody responding to it. Like a hashtag, yeah. We respond to that around wherever they are.
Yeah, it does. And hip hop, for example, I've heard when I'm in Italy, I hear Italian hip hop. When I'm in France, I hear French hip hop. But in the languages speaking, even though most young people speak English, they're in generally in the languages of those countries and speak to the stories of those countries. But so English is universal in the sense that it's spoken everywhere. And so that we get stories in English, but we don't get stories coming back the other way. And even if you're right next door or across the channel, as we are in the UK, hard pressed to name an Italian hip hop artist or a French or a, you see, so it really is, this is the work that, you know, I've really undertaken. As a scholar and as a journalist, to really have these stories be told, because they, you know, they're not necessarily being told.
Well, one of the stories that you tell in your book, you know, you talk about streets being renamed. You talk about, you know, monuments, you know, some monuments actually coming down, you know, during some of the protests. And so I'm looking at, how important are these markers if you're trying to also deal with institutional racism?
Yeah. So these, when you're invisible, you know, it takes on, and especially if, when you're a minority in terms of numbers, it's very important that your presence is concretized where you are, because this sense of belonging, this sense of place, this sense of contribution, are all kind of symbolized, you know, with these physical objects, these physical markers, these memorials, these markers, and these acknowledgements of these memories. For example, in London, we have a place called Windrush Square, which is really important to us and has been for generations. As a place where Black lives have been present and marked. For example, in Windrush Square, we have a monument to the African and Caribbean soldiers who fought in World War I and II. We don't have that anywhere else. We have a memorial to a mother, Cherry Gross, who was killed, who died after a police raid on her house looking for her son. She was injured in that raid and eventually died several years later. We have a memorial to her that was actually designed by the architect David Ajay, who was, you know, designed the African American Museum. And importantly, too, it's the home of the Black Cultural Archives, which is the place where our history is stored tells our history going back to Roman times.
Mm-hmm. So, but let's look at something that takes place on Olive Vassal. Is that, you know, sometimes we have these markers, we have these monuments, and then I'm looking at how these monuments and markers become target practice for racist groups. So, for example, the Emmett Till marker is always, somebody's always shooting at it. Recently, somebody took down the Jackie Robinson statue and melted it into, you know, copper or whatever. And so, you know, we put these things up. Or for example, now you look up here in the United States, we're changing the names back of military bases and stuff. So you can put the markers up, but sometimes the markers become a target practice or actual hates against the marker. And it just polarizes a community.
Yeah. And I hear you, and I think I can point to a case where that actually that happened in Paris, in the banlieue, which is the what it's called the suburbs, and that's a very sort of mild term for it, but it's a place where most people of color live, because they literally cannot afford to live in central Paris. And this particular banlieue is called Sarcelles. And there's a monument there to soldiers who fought with the French in the Second World War, I believe it was, called the Trailleurs. And that monument was attacked, cracked, split in two a few years after it was built. But the community rebuilt it, put it back together, and refused to be intimidated by these actions. And I think it's important to kind of show up in all the ways that you can show up, because I think that if you don't mark your presence, and you'll be assumed to be the kind of eternal arrivee who's never made any contribution, when you've made huge and long-lasting contribution to these communities. So I think it, you know, it is part of that. I mean, we mark as every other community marks. Mm-hmm. You know,
when I was looking at your book, and you have eight cities, and I want to look at that. There were two cities that I felt like might have been missing, you know. And I say that because your book also talks about, especially in terms of France, you're talking about colonization and things of that sort. So I was looking for Lisbon and Madrid. You know, I was looking for Portugal and Spain. That, like, why aren't those countries represented in the book?
And let me, yeah, I agree with you fully. And let me be kind of really honest here. This book was a labor of love for all of the contributors, and all of the contributors live in these places and have either born there or have long lived experiences. So we encountered a few challenges, one of which was the book was, we decided it would be written in English, an unfair advantage. It meant everybody else was writing in, you know, their second language, which, if you can imagine, again, speaks to the issue of war. Mm-hmm. And then we also had to find people who had the time in all of these countries to do that. So as we met people and we engaged people, we saw what people could do or couldn't do. And so it ended up being a practical case of, you know, who can do this contribution at this time, who can write in English and do this kind of work. And all of us as academics and journalists and, you know, activists, we were volunteering our time to do this. And it was, as you can imagine, an extensive amount of work, of research, of traveling to places.
How long did it take to do this book?
Oh, well, we started in 2018. We started doing the work, and we got interrupted by COVID. Mm-hmm. And we finally published in 2023. So it was a long commitment, you know, 5-year commitment, and people, you know, came and went as they were able to kind of engage.
You know, when I picked up the book, I saw a reference to one of my favorite countries. And I said, oh, Oslo is in here. So who is your friend living in Oslo, Norway, that contributed?
And we were very, very lucky to get Michelle A. Tisdale, and she's actually an African-American. And she moved to Oslo 20 plus years ago and raised her child there, and is working at the National Library. And so she was a delight on many levels, because if anybody knows anything about Norwegian, it's really incomprehensible.
It's a very difficult language.
I can get around in Italy.
Almost everybody there speaks English.
they do. A lot of the research material, though, that's in Norwegian. So, and she really was our guide through this. She was amazing. She has deep roots in the community. She actually put on an amazing exhibition at the Museum of Oslo, where we spoke about the book, about the art artifacts from the Black Lives Matter protest there in 2020. And it was amazing. And it brought in the work of indigenous communities and activists who've been working for years. Activists of African descent have been working for years in that.
What issues were they dealing with in Oslo? What issues that were, you know, because we're looking at police brutality in these cities. What were some of the major issues in Oslo?
Well, I think a lot of what Oslo faces is kind of the same thing that we all face. You know, kind of invisibility was a big one that was going on. And the actual understanding of how Norway had contributed to the slave trade and all of that.
We'll stop right there with the slave trade. We'll get back to the slave trade in a minute, but we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Olla Vassil, which she is the author of, actually the editor with Natasha Kelly, of the book Mapping Black Europe, Monuments, Markers, and Memories. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of February 17th, 2025. On February 20th at 1 p.m. to 2:30, the D.C. Guaranteed Income Coalition will hold a Black History Month celebration to encourage D.C. towards a path out of poverty. It will be at 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info can be found at dcgicoalition.org. On Saturday, February 22nd, there will be a State of the Black Child Community Town Hall held at 5 p.m. located at 2004 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C., 20020. More info can be found on busboysandpoets.com. Also on Saturday, February 22nd at 6 p.m., DCAARPR presents a People's Hearing on Policing and Public Safety at 901 G Street Northwest MLK Library Auditorium. More info can be found on Instagram at DMVPYM. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. If you value this social justice calendar, please make a donation for our Winter Pledge Drive by going to wpfwfm.org and clicking the red donate button. Thank you.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Olla Vassil. Olla, you know, there is a passage in your book which I think is very timely. While you're writing this book, there were racial incidents taking place in Poland while Russia was invading Ukraine. You make a reference to that in the book. Yeah. And I remember there were African students who were like in Ukraine who were trying to get out, and you know, they were pulling some of the African students off the train because they were taking up the place for Ukrainian. Could you talk about that incident? Because that deals with, you know, the Black presence in Europe.
Yeah. Poland's very interesting. France, there are no real sort of figures on the Black community there. And a lot of the work has been done by a friend of mine whose name is James Amolo. And he's literally doing primary research around issues affecting people of African descent. Many of the Black residents of Poland came, you know, as a result of relationships during communism, and they came to study in Poland. And so there's a very small Black community there. But Poland has been very, and even the Polish government has been very clear that black people are not welcomed. People of African descent are not welcomed in Poland. So this has been, you know, this is not hidden. So seeing when that happened, when those students and others were you know, denied or from leaving Poland, that was not a surprise to anybody who knew anything about Poland and the black presence there. And so they've really have an uphill battle, if you like, in terms of concretizing their presence, and churches and some community organizations are kind of doing that work, kind of in terms of gathering peoples together and making sure that they feel safe or that they have information. But this is very much on the sort of, if you like, the growing end of what needs to happen in this particular European country. Europe is very diverse in terms of the numbers of black people and also their positions. Mm-hmm. And so this is what makes it kind of tricky. You can't sort of look at it overall. I mean, France has the highest number of people of African descent, and then probably Poland the lowest. So there's a kind of huge scale there, and everybody's kind of fighting in the trenches. And you see incidents like this that shows you the nature of the fight that they're engaged in. Where are you? Are you in the parliament, or are they stopping you from, you know, leaving the country? You see, so
it's, right.
So it's a wide scale, and that's why it's important for us. It was so important for us to connect as a continent and to begin to learn each other's stories and see where we were and how we could offer each other help.
Talking about stories, I want to go back to Black, the chapter 6 in Black Paris, because you have two women that I want you to talk about, who are sisters, Paulette and Jane Nardal.
Yes, love the Nardals, being women and loving the whole idea of these salons. Okay, so they were involved in the Negritude movement along with Senghor and Césaire.
And Damas.
And Damas, exactly. Mm. But at that time, and some would argue now, they were not prominently featured in.
You're saying they were doing the work.
They were bringing people into their homes and really having discussions that really helped formulate the movement. But they themselves were very concerned that they would be left out of any histories around the work that they were doing. And while Césaire and Senghor have markers around, you know, who they were and their contributions to France, and Césaire, there's even a plaque in the Pantheon, which is a place where all the great French people are kind of memorialized. The sisters were largely left out, and these were women who were brilliant, you know, the first at this, the first at that. But there is a some markers in a small park in Paris to the women. And Paulette in particular, there is an association that is trying to get her acknowledged in the Pantheon that I talked about. It's an ongoing association.
You know, along with this, Basil, it seems that the markers and things, that's, I understand that, but it seems as if these women, let's take the two sisters here, Nardal, there should be biographies on them.
Yes.
You know, so where are the, you know, here, for example, in the States here, you know, we have like Alexis Gums doing, you know, Audre Lorde, you know, you have a number of women saying, okay, this woman, I'm going to do Lorraine Hansberry's, you know, biography, you know. Is that not happening over in France? That someone said, okay, let me, you know, I've been studying the Negritude movement. These women are very important and I'm going to do a biography.
Yeah, to a certain extent, but not to the extent that it needs to happen, not to the extent that it's being done on the males, for example, in the movement. And you see magazine articles, you see, you know, mentions, but you don't see the level of work and interest. And the association that I talked about is really driving that work to make sure that Paulette in particular is kind of acknowledged for her contribution, you know, and her sister's contribution to the movement. And if we say that speaks to that time in terms of how they were shut out, but today that should obviously be different, but then that speaks to maybe some of the issues that we're dealing with that continue to be a problem for us today.
Let's talk about another issue. You know, we have the markers and monuments that to me are outside. What's happening in terms of, say, museums with exhibits? Because I feel that many times outside the, or in addition to the classroom, the museum plays a key role in a society.
Yeah. And that, again, you know, every question you ask me, I know I always say it varies because it really does. It really depends on what country you're talking about and how the importance it places on Black histories or not. So you see that there are, in the UK, for example, which is perhaps very much more conscious, if you like, mm-hmm. of its Black histories. You see a lot more exhibitions, museum exhibitions across the museum space, from the portrait gallery to smaller spaces. You do see more of that. And of course, we ourselves have our own exhibitions in places like the Black Cultural Archives. So we, you know, in the UK in particular, I see a lot of that happening. In France, there was an attempt to build a national memorial, which is probably on the scale of which would have museum exhibits, to the victims of enslavement, but that stalled in kind of 2020 and is kind of ongoing. So a lot of what I've seen in France is happening in community spaces like Little Africa in you know, the Pigalle area. So you're seeing these activities, and there's some organizations that have had, this is in France, exhibitions, some outdoor, but there are a variety of different activities happening, but more so.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you because I want to find out what type of activities happening here at WPFW. Okay, Tia, what activities are happening here? Are we raising any money as we listen to Oliver Vassal?
Well, we are. We want to say thank you to first Richard Scowcroft from the last hour. He made a pledge at the very end of Democracy Now! So thank you. We also want to say thank you to Anonymous, who got us started for On the Margin. And it's Anonymous out of Silver Spring in memory of Faith David Ruffins Law and Sterling A. Brown. Beautiful. And of course, Faith was a longtime supporter, major donor of WPFW. So thank you for that. Still $400 to go, Ethelbert. The number to call everyone is 800-222-9739, or you can go to WPFWFM.org. Those are the ways to connect. We have an easy lift now of $400. Consider someone out there, consider becoming a sustaining member. Maybe two people pledging at the $200 level, four people pledging at the $400 level, eight people pledging at the $50 level. Let us make this goal for Ethelbert. It is a fascinating conversation about what happens throughout the African diaspora to Black people. And of course, we hear that the experiences are all too similar. So now is your opportunity to get in on this conversation, support that which supports you, be in solidarity with what Ethelbert is doing, 800-222-9739, and Ms. Vassal is doing, the great work she is doing, or WPFWFM.org, and hopefully we'll have more folks to thank, Ethelbert.
Okay, well, I'm back on the, I'm thinking now, Oliver, you and I met on a metro.
We did, so yeah.
You know, like, we were like in that play that by Leroy Jones, The Dutchman. Just a joke. Anyway, talk about you, you know, we were talking at the beginning of the show about police brutality, and we know that many times the media is really important. You have really been involved in the media for, you know, throughout your life. And I want to know about, you know, Euromite that you created, and just how you see the role of the media at this particular point in time in dealing with issues of race.
Okay. I am a journalist by trade and started working at the BBC on a really pioneering show called Black Londoners, a radio show. And this was in the 80s. And really at that time, we were engaging around, you know, some of the earlier efforts. And there are people that came before us, please. But some of the consistent efforts within, you know, official structures of consistently telling Black stories from not just London, which is a hub, but all around the country. So I've been involved in journalism for a long time. I actually began my career at a little newspaper called West Indian World, which was in North London. I still remember it. And again, told stories, documented the histories and the issues of Black people at the time. It was one of several newspapers at the time. We're now down to one called The Voice newspaper. I've decided to start my own website, Euromite, in 2009, as I delved more into the Black European story. And at that time, you know, it was just really the opening of, sort of cooperation across country lines in terms of telling the stories from other European countries. So I would tell the stories from Italy, France. I even had a translation little button. So if I had an Italian story, I could put that in English so that other people could understand. And there was another important vehicle called the Afro-European blog at that time that was doing the same work. And ironically, that person was the person that years later ended up writing the chapter on Brussels. So that connection, it was a very small community. But as the internet sort of developed, we were able to have more and more content, more and more people in each country were doing work. I was able to incorporate that into the site. And then I finally got to the point where I realized that everybody was now able to tell their own story. Mm-hmm. And I could go back and focus, which I did in 2022, could go back and focus wholeheartedly on the UK with a online magazine called Be Brit Project, which is Black Brit or Be Brit, whichever you want to say, project, which now focuses solely on the UK. But I still am engaged, especially in my scholarship, around Black Europe and what is going on there and keeping abreast of that and just engaging with scholars, journalists, people doing the work in other countries, which I think is really important for us, that we have to continue to talk to each other and that media vehicles are really the primary ways that we get to know each other's stories.
Well, I've been happy to you know, meeting you and hearing this story. I'm wondering if I was a student at UDC and you are there working with the running the digital media program, would I get these stories or would you just be teaching me how to do technical things? Would I get all this other good stuff that you've been talking about this last hour?
You do, because one of the things, yes, great question, but one of the things that we all do at UDC, and I certainly do, is make sure that my scholarship is part of, you know, what students and how, you know, uses content for how students learn. So for example, in a magazine writing class, you know, you don't just write a story about something going on in the US, but you write something about something going on in Europe, Black Europe. You know, when I do work, if I say I just shot a news story in Leicester in the UK, well, one of my students did the technical work on that. But as she did that in putting together the story, she learned about this community. So yeah, I very much embed my work into my teaching practice at UDC, because I think it's really important that this generation of students really, really know the stories of those, not just in their communities or in their nation, but, you know, across the diaspora. So it's really important. What I don't want is what, you know, them to be in the same positions when I came here 20 years ago or so, that they didn't know my story. I want them to know everybody's story. And of course, it's a lot. The media now has really shown much more this diversity in the African diaspora that is accessible, especially in the entertainment industry. You know, you really see that a lot. You see, everybody knows that, well, may or may not know that, say, somebody like Idris Elba is British. And so that sort of communication is much more prevalent than it was, for example, when I came here. And there's a more of a natural curiosity. And one of the things that we hope to do in the future is take students, you know, over to Europe and have them have experiences that are, you know, diverse.
If you like. Well, you know, one of the things that you mentioned in your book, Mapping Black Europe, which I think is really important, you talk about, you know, monuments can be built, but sometimes the stories are not remembered.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and sometimes they're not remembered. And so as a teacher, I find it very important to make sure that, you know, each generation that I teach, or each generation that I connect with, whether it's here in the US or in the UK or somewhere else in Europe, that the information about who we are, how we got here, what our story is, what our contributions are very much, you know, part of the conversation. For example, my niece was part of a project called the Young Historian Project, which was put together by a great scholar. His name is Hakim Adi, and you've probably certainly heard of him. And he wrote really a definitive book on the Black African and Caribbeans in the UK. I mean, a just amazing, really book. It's
You know, when you say that, I was also wondering about how important to your work has been, like, the writings of Gilroy, you know, with this whole idea of the Black Atlantic. Has that been part of your education?
Yes, most definitely. We've really looked to those who came before us, Paul Gilroy, Stuart Hall. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who've really been doing this work. Yeah, that's the foundation on which we've built the work we do, and you know, the ways in which we kind of communicate and talk to each other across sort of geographic lines.
Well, that's, I'm going to check with the foundation of WPFW, see what's happening with that. Katia, are you there? Maybe it's Katia.
Yes,
out.
I am, Ethelbert.
Okay.
Yes,
now, how are we doing on the fundraising?
We actually need $200 more. So we're asking folks to go to the phones right now, 800-222-9739. We only have 10 minutes to do it. This is my last appeal to you on behalf of Ethelbert. We need your support. We want your support. We're so close to this goal. WPFW-FM, this has been a marvelous conversation. Thank you both so much. And I know the audience is thanking you. And one way you can thank Ethelbert and this wonderful guest directly is by, we have also Anonymous, who says, I would like my donation to be anonymous. This important work, spreading information about the Black diaspora. Absolutely. 800-222-9739, 175 to go. We're so close. Let's get Ethelbert over the hump here, over a goal. We can do it together. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org.
Oliver, I want to go before, you know, we have a few more minutes. You know, one of the things that comes out in this conversation, especially when you look at your book, is the fact that I was wondering, say at UDC, how many of the young students that you're working with are, you know, speak more than one language?
Oh, yes. At UDC, we're very fortunate because we have quite a quite a sizable body of international students, some from speak more than one language. I would say French, Spanish, definitely, and we have you know, a significant Spanish-speaking population that's growing kind of every day. And one of the things we do in that regard is to, even in the classroom, I'm working for example with a student right now who is doing his work both in English and in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, first of all, he's able to reach his community and other communities. as well as, you know, communities with the dominant language. So yeah, so we have people who speak at least one other language. You have some people from who speak French, who are from Africa and France itself. So we kind of pride ourselves on having an international community, a body of students that we engage them in telling their stories, which is
okay. Important. Well, you've been telling some wonderful stories this last hour, and I want to thank you for being my guest on the margins, Alex Basil. You are the author, along with Natasha Kelly, of Mapping Black Europe: Monuments, Markers, and Memories. Okay. Very important book in terms of who we are, not just here, but everywhere. Okay, so I want to thank you for being my guest. The show's On the Margin, the station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hola, mi gente. Soy Oscar Fernandez del Latino Media Collective en WPFW, aquí para decirle a ustedes que todas las personas en los Estados Unidos tienen derechos independientemente de su estado migratorio, y conociendo nuestros derechos es el primer paso para mantenernos a distancia de las violaciones de nuestros derechos como ICE y otras fuerzas de orden. Por eso le presento una guía para proteger sus derechos. Número 1. Identifique los contactos de emergencia y memorice sus números. Número 2. Mantenga la calma si se acerca el ICE o otras fuerzas del orden. No corra, discuta, resista ni pelea. Número 3. Tenemos el derecho a permanecer en silencio. Número 4. Tiene derecho a hablar con un abogado y no firmar nada hasta que lo discuta con un abogado. Número 5. Si está en su casa, tiene derecho a negarse a entrar a menos que se le presente una orden judicial firmada por un juez. Una orden de ICE no permite la entrada a su casa. Y finalmente, número 6, usted tiene derecho a un intérprete. WPFW está aquí defendiendo los derechos humanos ganados con dificultad, construyendo un mundo más justo, transmisión a transmisión.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Stacia Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions, Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Whether it's the courage to tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms, blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our winter pledge drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for change makers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information are available at www.diversityfund.org. You can send questions to info@diversityfund.org. Upcoming info session dates and recordings are accessible online at www.diversecityfund.org. The phone number for further information is 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130. Black as you, black as me, black as us,
black as free. Black as me, black as us, black as free. Black as us. For close to 50 years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black History. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801.